Hello, everyone. This is Julie Shane, and I'm the Deputy Director of the National Center on Elder Abuse. Today, we present for you from the National Center on Elder Abuse, a segment on Lifting Up Voices of Older Survivors podcast. And it will be my pleasure today to be working with Jim Vandenbosch of Terra Nova Films and Bonnie Brandel, the founder and director of the National Clearinghouse on Abuse in Later Life, otherwise known as NCAL. We are so fortunate to have NCAL with us today because they have been very successful in encouraging older survivors who've experienced violence to speak out through a unified theme of lifting up voices. NCAL began a partnership in 2007 with Terra Nova Films with funding from the Department of Justice's Office for Victims of Crime. And they've developed videos which feature older survivors throughout the United States, sharing stories and experiences ranging from domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, and financial exploitation. The National Center on Elder Abuse, for those of you who aren't acquainted with us, also known as the NCA, provides the latest information regarding research, training, best practices, news, and resources on elder abuse, neglect, and exploitation, and we provide that to professionals and the public at large. We are one of 27 Administration on Community Living funded resource centers, and we recognize that as a society and as individuals, we must increase our efforts to ensure that all older adults age with dignity and honor. And right now, while we're recording this segment, we are in the midst of COVID-19, and that has certainly put a strain on our ability to meet the challenges that this presents to the elder justice field. We're all feeling the restrictions imposed on us to remain physically distanced from our loved ones, yet stay connected to community supports, and this has presented a whole array of unknowns for us to work through. We do anticipate an upswing in elder abuse cases, and we expect changes to services and legal systems, the access to advocates and officials, and really who knows what else we might encounter. And I just want to commend that Bonnie Brandel, one of our speakers today, has organized a weekly call of national elder justice providers, and together we are joining forces to meet these challenges. So without further ado, I would like to welcome Jim and Bonnie for being here today and providing us further information. Welcome, Jim and Bonnie.
Thank you, Julie.
Thank you.
Hi. Well, many people need to know about your relationship and how you got started in this. NCAL and Terra Nova Films have an outstanding reputation for creating meaningful, thoughtful videos together. How did this project evolve?
Thank you, Julie, for and all of the staff at the National Center on Elder Abuse for inviting us to have this conversation. And yes, you're right. The National Clearinghouse on Abuse in Later Life and Terra Nova Films have a long relationship working together. I started doing this work back in the 1990s. And in the late 1990s and early 2000s, I was going around the country doing a lot of presentations, raising awareness about domestic violence and sexual assault in later life and elder abuse. And I really wanted to bring the voices of older adults into the room and have them telling their stories and not speaking about them without them being present and really sharing their experiences. But as I attempted to do that, I found there were a number of struggles when I would invite older survivors to attend a presentation. Some people were uncomfortable speaking. Some had safety issues, some said yes, but later had health issues by the time we got ready to do the presentation. And so it started to become clear that it might make sense to be working with a video producer to capture some of the stories on video and then be able to bring them into the room while I was doing training. And so we were fortunate back in the early 2000s, maybe 2006, 2007, that the Office for Victims of Crime put out a request for proposals to do exactly that kind of a video project. And so I had seen Jim's fabulous work with Norman and Pat to Just to Have a Peaceful Life, called him, and we came up with a project that we did a number of years ago called In Their Own Words, where Miss Mary and other older survivors were filmed. And over the past more than a decade, those videos have been used around the world by trainers and others to lift up the awareness of elder abuse. So a couple of years ago in 2017, the Office for Victims of Crime again put out a request for proposals that included the opportunity to create videos. So of course, after the wonderful experience that I had had working with Terra Nova Films and the incredible impact that the original videos had, I called Jim up and said, are you game to do this again? And we put together this project called Lifting Up Voices, where we went back out into communities and filmed older survivors. So that's sort of my story. Jim, do you want to talk about why filming older survivors and elder abuse has been so important for you?
Sure. Before I met Bonnie, I had already started to explore and do some some videos about the elder abuse issue. As Bonnie referred to, that included a film called Elder Abuse 5 Case Studies, which included the story of Norman and the story of Pat. And that film had been used quite a bit. And I learned, I think, through that that experience, the value and the importance of letting people have their own voice around what they experienced and letting them tell their story rather than always filtering it through the voices of others, which I think prior to that had been kind of the norm. So I think just the title of those programs alone, the first one we called In Their Own Words, and this last one, Lifting Up the Voices, says something about what we're after, which is to actually give voice to the victims and survivors of elder abuse. The other thing I guess I want to say is that there's something inherently powerful about stories that we as human beings respond to. And I think especially if those stories are told on camera, they just have a kind of power that enables the viewer to empathize and to learn from the experience of people who have been through the victimization process and hopefully coming out of that as a survivor.
Yeah, Jim, I agree with everything that you're saying. And we really, with this last project, as you mentioned, learned from the original video that you did, the 5 case studies, and then In Their Own Words, and really wanted to frame these stories showing the strength and resiliency of older survivors. And so we're in particular looking for those stories, in part because we wanted to address the ageism that we see out in the country and across the world, this notion that older victims are vulnerable and frail, maybe unable to make their own decisions. And certainly there are some who struggle with health issues and dementia and other things, but there are a lot of people who end up being harmed by family members or caregivers or other people in their life who go through that experience and come out and become advocates or spokespeople for the issue or go on and do pretty incredible things within their community. And we wanted to be sure that those stories were put forward as well.
Yeah, and I think just to add to that, we discussed this, the four of us who were producing this last program, we had a chance to sit down afterwards and just talk about the process. And what we reflected on was the way in which you approach telling the story, the way in which you work with the people who are telling their stories is part of what makes the project either successful or not successful. And by that, I mean, we really take pains not to sensationalize what's happening, which I think is in contrast to what the mainstream media does. If you've seen programs on elder abuse, it tends to sensationalize those issues and the people that are going through that experience rather than take a more balanced view, which is what we tried to do. We tried to always find an arc, a story arc in each of the stories that we told, which gave you kind of the background of what was happening for this person and what they were living through, but it usually ended on a more hopeful note. So that that's what I mean by a more balanced approach. And the other thing we learned is that we need to create a really safe and respectful place and experience and context for the people who are telling their stories, which is what we also really tried to do.
Yeah, Jim, as one who's experienced your videos and utilized them in my career, I was wondering if you would be able to give the listener some examples that illustrate the effect that these stories have and share them.
Yeah, I think we have four examples that we want to share with you. And we're going to show video clips, short video clips of each of those. Bonnie, you want to introduce the first one?
Sure. And before I introduce the first one, let me just do a little bit of context of the number of stories that we filmed. So in our original proposal, we said we would we go to five different communities and film five stories. In the end, we did go to five different areas of the country, but we ended up filming 11 stories and putting nine of those stories out into the field for your use. And we attempted in creating these stories to look at a number of things in terms of diversity, making sure that we had men and women, people of different ages, people from different racial backgrounds, from different parts of the country, looking at some urban and rural settings, and also the different forms of abuse that we filmed. And so we wanted to make sure that we included intimate partner violence, sexual abuse, financial exploitation, and as you know, many of those forms co-occur. So we've got four short video clips that we want to show you that illustrate some of those different forms. And the first example is Tammy from Arizona. She is a victim of intimate partner violence and also talks about, in the context of that, both physical and sexual abuse. So this clip is her describing a little bit of what her experience was and then the steps that she took to end that relationship.
It got to a point where he was really strong-arming me, you know, like he'd take my arm and twist it behind my back and try and force me to do what I didn't want to do. And, you know, there was a couple of times when he'd do that, and I'm not as strong as him. I'm not a man. I couldn't handle that, but he would try and force himself. So, I mean, it got to a point where I threatened to call the police if he didn't leave me alone. I needed to go. I needed to get away. I didn't want to see him. I didn't want to have anything to do with him. I didn't want him to come back there. I didn't want to have a confrontation with him. And so that's what I did. I packed up everything and moved it into a storage. Went back to the apartment, wrote a note, left the key for the apartment. I left the key there and I wrote and I called the manager and told him that I was moving out and I wasn't going to come back. I was leaving the key. And as I closed the door, I'm locked out now. I'm thinking, what am I gonna do? I don't have money to go rent a motel or anything like that. So, and it's all, I'm hot and sweaty. And so by now it's dark and I'm thinking, where am I gonna go? I don't know anybody out here. So what did I do? I went back to the storage that I had rented, put the things in. And that's where I stayed that night. I didn't know what else to do.
Wow, that is so powerful. That's just amazing.
So following what Julie said, this is what I would say. So Tammy's story is a great illustration of intimate partner violence. She goes into talking about sexual abuse as well. And then she describes what services were helpful for her. And so we hear about her experience in transitional housing and the benefits that support groups were for her. Jim, is there anything you would want to add about Tammy's story?
Just that when I reflect on Tammy's story, what amazes me is the courage that she had to tell a story of a sexual nature, which is kind of taboo in our culture, especially, you know, when she was being mistreated sexually. And for her to be very open and forthright about that, I think just really contributed to a topic that people really don't often know actually exists.
Yeah, I think, Jim, we've had the privilege to film Miss Mary, and that's a video of a 96-year-old woman who was sexually assaulted by her grandson. For the previous project in this series, there's a film of Linda as well, who was sexually assaulted by a stranger. And to your point, this is a topic that is difficult for people to talk about. And so those survivors who are willing to come forward and share their story, it's really important to put the message out there that unfortunately sexual abuse does happen in later life. And yet there are services that are available in the cases of all three of those women. The advocacy agencies that they worked with in their community made a tremendous difference in terms of helping them with healing and moving on to the next stages of their life.
Yeah, just one more comment. I think that you can hear it in Tammy's voice when you listen to her whole story, at how overwhelmed she was to have found the safe place that she could go to and get help with her predicament. Unfortunately, that is not the norm across the country, but the place that she found in Phoenix is a model of what should happen, where she had her own little apartment in a kind of a community of other women who had experienced being victims.
Yes, I agree. And the fact that Tammy was able to use transitional housing was great. And that is also true for Donna, who is the next story that we're going to show. So Jim, do you want to set up Donna's story before we see the video?
Donna is an example of someone who lives in a fairly rural community. And one of our goals of this program was to try to find a situation of elder abuse in a very rural community because it has unique characteristics of its own. We can discuss this a little bit more lately, but we actually found that a lot of the issues that we hoped would come out did not. But what did come out of this story and touched me deeply was the fact that, like a lot of people who are in rural communities, Donna was fairly isolated by her abuser. And she, at some point, found the courage to get out of that. And that's basically the whole story that she tells. And I'll have more to say about it after we see this very short clip.
He would say stuff like, the only reason I keep you around is so I can see the grandkids. You'll never make it without. This was a constant everyday thing. You're not going to make it. Your credit stinks. Nobody wants you. It was just put downs all the time. My self-esteem was gone. I didn't see no hope. I didn't see any end. I'll be honest. I wanted to kill myself. I had thought I was so unhappy and I didn't know how to get out of it. So I needed some outlet to talk to somebody. I was so miserable. I don't know how many times I thought about driving off the bridge on my way to work or whatever. I just, sometimes when you feel trapped, you don't know what to do. You don't know where to go.
The abuse was more emotional and verbal and financial and just controlling than it was physical abuse. And very often that's the type of abuse that's hard for somebody to recognize. It's hard for people out in the community to recognize, but also hard for a victim to recognize and label as being domestic violence.
So what of all the stories that we did, I mean, each one had its own uniqueness and its own power, but somehow I found myself really, really moved by Donna's story. And when I reflect on it, I think it's because she basically had to reinvent herself after living through that experience of abuse. And she found a way to do that with the help of some other professionals in the community that helped her in many different ways. But she basically did it. I mean, she left that situation and she reinvented herself to the point where I remember she said, when I was in high school, I would take a zero rather than stand up and give a speech in front of the class. That's the kind of shy person that she was. And in the end, she was able to get up in front of a crowd of 400 people and talk about her experience and what she had gone through and how she came out of it. Actually, I have to tell you, the way she ends it is very typical of how she talks. She says, "I get teary-eyed because I'm so happy right now. And that's worth anything and everything to me." That's how we end the video.
Yeah, I love Donna's story, Jim, as well, for a lot of all the reasons that you talked about. And some similarities between Donna and Tammy's story are that both of these women were in that age group of 50 to 61. And it's often really difficult for people in that particular age range to be able to find services and economic support. They're not old enough for Social Security and Medicare, and yet not without having dependent children at home, are often not eligible for many types of assistance that are designed for families. So it was really a gift to be able to highlight their stories. They're both women who use transitional housing and benefited from a variety of services offered by domestic violence programs that took the time to tailor their services to meet the needs of older victims. So Jim, do you want to say anything else about Donna before we move to Charlotte?
No, I think I've said what I need to say about Donna.
All right. So on this, in the series of nine, we have, as I mentioned, two stories that focus on sexual abuse, four stories that focus on intimate partner violence, and then we also have four stories that focus on financial exploitation. And again, some of these forms are co-occurring. The next couple of clips that we're going to show you are both focused on financial exploitation. And so the next one is going to be Charlotte. And she's going to talk about how she and her husband were financially exploited by a woman who befriended them. And over 7 years, this woman financially exploited around $600,000 from her. And in this very short clip that you're about to see, she's going to describe what it felt like when they made the decision to reach out for help and contact law enforcement.
It took nerve to call the police. It's interesting because there was an attachment of a negative nature at the same time, and to realize that we really had been conned. I don't know whether it was a kind of acknowledging that we were, I was going to say, caught red-handed. We were the victims and we were caught red-handed. Isn't that an interesting thing to say? The humility and the embarrassment of having to admit it to the world. I think that was some of the hesitation. Whether I was maybe even on some unconscious level protecting someone I'd been taken care of, so to speak, I don't know. Maybe that's a rationalization. And the truth is, I was just plain humiliated for us.
So in this clip, we get to hear from Charlotte and Howard. In the longer version that you can watch on our website, Lifting Up Voices, Charlotte talks about the experience of financial exploitation, talks about what it was like, as you saw, to be involved with the criminal justice system. And then we hear from the prosecutor in the case about some of what happened on the criminal justice end. There's another case in this series, or video in this series, Mary Ann, that tells a similar story of a woman being befriended and then what happened with the law enforcement investigation and the prosecution. So these are really powerful stories of financial exploitation, but also I think do a great job of illustrating the benefits of for many victims of being involved with the criminal justice.
Yeah, the other interesting piece about this story is that Howard, Charlotte's husband, was in very poor health around the time that they finally got in touch with law enforcement and got the case prosecuted. And in order to accept his testimony, the judge allowed for them to do it at home. So he was actually deposed, I think, by Skype or some distance way that he could physically be on camera answering the questions involved in the prosecution. So it was just added a whole other level. And shortly after that, he actually passed away. So Charlotte was left to tell the story in person, but we also had Howard's entity there on video that we were able to use. All right, so this clip is going to show you, it's a little bit longer, and the reason for that is it's actually about two different victims, survivors, of a financial scam that happened. They're both from the same community. They did not know each other prior to us filming them, but they lived in the same general area. And this introductory clip is going to show you two different men, one of them named Leonard, the other one named Leo. It runs a little bit longer. I think it's close to 4 minutes, but let's take a look and then we can talk about it some more afterwards.
I got my groceries, went out and got into my car, and this man came walking between the cars, and it was kind of a misty morning, and he said that someone had just scammed him out of $500, a taxi driver, and dropped him off and said he'd be back to pick him up, but he didn't know where he was at or how to get anywhere because he just had flown in from Africa, and that he had gotten a large inheritance, and that but he had to distribute money to the needy, hungry people before he could get his portion of the inheritance. And he had a letter that he pulled out to show me.
Two people select a good victim, target them, and then scam them. And what they do essentially is person A approaches someone in usually a parking lot of a store. They always select someone who's older, in my experience. The story that usually comes out is that they are from Africa, they've just inherited millions of dollars, and they have to give this money to some kind of charity.
My dad's always had a really kind heart and has always been in it to help people. And when they used the story that it was to help other people, I mean, they had him at that. I mean, that was where his heart was on that. So, of course, he was going to listen to what they had to say because he wanted to be out there helping people.
Oh, this is a good time to help the church. I might be able to help my church. At the same time, some sickly nephews and nieces in the Philippines, I might send them part of my 10,000 money. Before we drove to my bank, we made a pact. A pact like brotherhood pact. We Sierra Leone's hand, my hand, and James' hand. So like a praying brotherhood, like trust each other. The Sierra Leone guy started to pray with foreign or strange fast expressions like that. But that's okay. My turn. Oh, it's your turn, Mr. Leo. Okay, you want me to? I will. So I ask God's. I thank God's blessings that all these things that we are going to do will be in His guidance and His direction, and protect us from any harm. That was a sincere prayer. A sincere prayer. As soon as I gave the 5,000, he pretended again to put the money inside the glove compartment. And now it's my turn to walk around the block to show him that I trusted him too. Silly me, I added more blocks. When I got there, they're no longer there.
What actually strikes me about these two cases is we were fortunate enough when we went to Seattle and worked with Paige Ulrey to find some cases for this video series. She actually had these two cases that were pending. where they had actually, and we do, we go through the whole story. We tell the story from the beginning to the end, where they had found the perpetrators of these crimes in both cases, and were in the process of either prosecuting or doing a plea bargain. So we were able to track that entire arc of the story. And the fact that two of these were in the same community and we could talk to both individuals was really fortunate for us. And we actually end the video with a scene of the sentencing of Leonard. And then we talk about Leo, the perpetrator in Leo's case also doing a plea bargain, I believe, and getting jail time as well. Bonnie, you want to add any more to this?
Yes. So I agree with everything that you just said, and also appreciate that we had two men who were willing to talk to us about their experience. I think sometimes it can be harder for older men to share an experience of victimization like this. And yet I really appreciated that both of these men wanted to make sure that other people were aware that these kinds of scams happen and to be careful for them. So they're caring hearts in terms of wanting to get a message out to people, I thought was really important. I was moved by both of them. You hear it in Leo's story on this clip, and it was true for Leonard as well, that these are both men of faith, and so helping others was important to them. And it really is a good reminder to us when we're thinking about audiences that potentially need training, the importance of reaching out to faith leaders who might hear some of these stories within their communities and could benefit from some information about elder abuse and resources that are available. And then another piece of the story that I particularly appreciate is that Leonard is a former homicide detective. And so this clip, I think, works particularly well with criminal justice audiences, law enforcement in particular, because they see someone who was an officer like they are, and also with prosecutors, to see some of the strategies that Paige used in this case, I think are great teaching points for folks.
Yes, I mean, these stories are just so informative and they have such impact. And Bonnie, you know, I've been in the audience in your trainings and they have provided me with so much guidance. I was wondering if Bonnie, you could maybe, and Jim, suggest ways of using these videos in advocacy and training endeavors?
Sure, I think there are a number of ways that the videos can be used. So they're currently housed on a website that is called Lifting Up Voices. And for some people, it might simply be self-education. You can go onto that website, you can click onto the video and watch the video from beginning to end. There are some discussion guides that have an opportunity for you to go through and look at the questions and do some individual reflection and fill out the guides to start really thinking about the teaching points that are in the videos. And Julie, as you mentioned at the beginning, we're taping this at a time when we're in the midst of a pandemic and many people are working from home. And so I think one thing people can do is raise their own awareness about elder abuse and some of the complex issues by simply watching these individually. But I also think it's a great opportunity to use these videos and materials in training. And again, because we're doing so much virtually right now, I think a lot of people are spending a lot of time looking at screens and attending webinars and other kinds of meetings. And I think a way to get to people's hearts and minds going beyond just sort of a standard PowerPoint is using some of these videos within a webinar setting to tell these stories and then create some opportunity for conversation. And again, the videos come all with discussion guides that can be used either for individual reflection, or those questions can be used by a facilitator as well to engage a group in some additional conversation. And I think it's also important to, as you're thinking about World Elder Abuse Awareness Day for any year, that this theme that I so appreciate that the National Center on Elder Abuse has embraced about lifting up voices is one that can be used every year with World Elder Abuse Awareness Day activities. And sometimes for communities, that can be bringing forward some older survivors to media events or to trainings or other kinds of things. But these videos are also available. So in case it's not possible to have older adults telling their stories within your communities, that you can use these stories to raise awareness with community members, professionals, the media, and others.
Yes, Bonnie, thanks for bringing up World Elder Abuse Awareness Day, which is June 15th. And we really want to encourage people to go on the website, either National Centers or the Lifting Up Voices website, and utilize these videos and share them and make sure people are able to get the value that they provide. So do you have any next steps with this project?
We do, in fact. So one of the things that was really exciting about this project is that we built in an evaluation process and that it was required by the Office on for Victims of Crime. And we were really grateful to be able to do that because I think sometimes we put resources out there, but we don't really know if they have an impact or not, or if they have been helpful. So last year, near World Elder Abuse Awareness Day, we partnered with the National Center on Elder Abuse and did a live webinar where we launched this project and announced that we were going to do have it open for an evaluation process for a year. So anyone who goes to the Lifting Up Voices website will find the video, you'll find the discussion guide, and then you'll find an evaluation form where you can give us some feedback about both the discussion guide and the video. And we've had that open for a year, both on the website and as we've gone out and done training, we've distributed evaluations as well. And we have collected what we have gotten so far, which is almost a year's worth of data, and sent that off to Dr. Pam Teaster, who is our evaluator on this project. And she is currently calling through the data that we've got, and we'll be meeting with her in the next couple of weeks to look at the feedback and make some decisions about if we're going to go back into the draft materials and, based on what we have heard from the field, make edits to any of the videos or to the discussion guides. And then sometime this summer, we will finalize the product, take draft off the back of it, and do a second soft relaunch of letting people know that the materials are available to be downloaded in their final form.
Honey, I don't know if, do we want to talk at all about the two stories that we, at the end of the project, found and videotaped in Phoenix, and some of the issues that we had with those, and kind of the process we went through in making the decision to not include them in the project at this point?
Sure. But yeah, why don't you go ahead and do that, Jim? That would be
okay. There were two cases down there which were abuse of parents by adult children. And they were very sensitive cases because this is a sensitive issue for parents to talk about. Nobody wants to penalize their children. And yet, in particular, one of these cases, it had been some horrendous abuse, both financial and physical, on the part of the adult child. We did some pretty amazing interviews with both of these women and edited them, and then in the end we stepped back and evaluated whether it would compromise either of these women's safety to put these stories out in a very public way through a web format, and decided that it probably would, at least in one of these cases. So we just held the cases back, and it's something that we're going to look at again after a year or so goes by, see if anything has changed. But one of the ideas that we are thinking about is possibly using them not in a very public way, but when Bonnie goes around, if we ever get back to that point where we can do trainings in person, having these stories as one that she can show on a very individual basis to select audiences.
Yeah, Jim, I'm glad that you raised that for two reasons, because that is one of the next steps, is sort of us evaluating the footage that we did not use or put out publicly. So we both have these two stories, and we've got some other footage of other experts and some other pieces of footage that would be a great next step if we can find funding to sort of build out some of the stories or the footage that we've got, and taking a look at these other two cases. But I think it's really important that you're talking about that for people who might be thinking about doing a project similar to this one. It's been one of the most powerful and moving experiences of my professional career, and yet at the same time, very complicated, as we've had to really think ethically about putting people's stories forward and the safety concerns and the emotional concerns for people. And there's just been a lot that we have talked about. And while I would encourage people to really consider going out and filming people and lifting up more stories, if we could do that, to really do that thoughtfully and ethically, if they choose to take on a project like this.
I know, I feel like you've just scratched the surface on this whole subject, and I'm wondering if you have any desire to explore other filming locations or topics that would be particularly of interest. And just thinking about the array of topics and the forms of abuse there are, have you considered that, I hope?
Yeah, Julie, you're totally right. Yeah. Because when you've seen one elder abuse story, you've sort of in many ways just seen one story. There are so many forms of abuse and people's history that they bring and lived experiences and cultural and generational values and faith affiliation and. So yes, I would love, if my full-time job was to work with Jim on going around the country and finding more and more stories, if we have the funding to be able to do that. But one of the exciting things is that we in fact have already spun off another project as a result of this one. So last spring, Jim and NCAL staff went into Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and interviewed several older African-American victims of crime. And we are in the process of doing the final edits on that footage and putting together a toolkit for the field that we hope to release sometime in the next few months. Jim, what other ideas do you have for topics that you'd love to film?
Yeah, we've talked about this many times when we get together after some of the shooting was done. And a couple of the things that I don't think have been given enough attention in video, and partly because they are difficult to do or complex, but one of them is the whole issue of guardianship. I've read several articles in the last couple of years about how guardianship can be badly, badly abused. And it's usually a very long, complicated story to tell. So I'm not quite sure how we would get a handle on doing it, but it is a topic that we've thought about. Another that I don't think anybody has done anything with is the intersection of pet abuse, animal abuse, and domestic violence, particularly around elder abuse issues. They often, if an older person has a pet, they can go hand in hand. So that's something else that we've thought about. It would be good to do a video on. Then the other issue is around dementia. Often dementia is involved in elder abuse cases. And again, this is particularly tricky to get at, because you do want to honor the person who is living with dementia and letting them tell their own story as much as they can, and then probably filling it out with caregivers in some way. But I think that deserves some focus of its own. And then I think, Bonnie, we also talked about tribal communities, and that has its own unique issues in terms of jurisdiction and authority, and how do you get in and be trusted to tell the story in that community. So I don't know, is there anything you want to add, Bonnie?
Yeah, I remember when we were working on finalizing the stories that we were going to choose, we were hoping we would be able to get all the different forms of abuse, and really I think struggled with finding a story that could be told from the victim's perspective of a victim of neglect. And I think that gets a little bit at what you were talking about with dementia and other cognitive challenges. And then just sort of echoing what we talked about a few minutes ago, that so many of these victims, the abuser or the person harming them is an adult child or a grandchild. And I would love to see more stories out there that we could show other older adults so that they, people could see that this happens to, unfortunately, way too many people. But the challenge in filming those stories is that often the older adult wants to keep a connection and a relationship with the person that's harming them, even if there is a protection order or some separation. And so to be able to put a story out on film that really exposes what's going on in that family and to do that safely, I think is particularly challenging.
I cannot agree more. And I think now we put that into the frame of here we are at COVID quarantine and we're in a whole nother dynamic. And it's one of those things that those of us in the elder justice community, well, we know that social isolation is one of the greatest risk factors in elder abuse. My fear is that one catastrophe is going to breed another. So of course, these videos are really going to help us. We're going to be more connected. Hopefully we can encourage people to make those phone calls to older adults, check in on an older neighbor, write a card or a letter, or think of all these positive steps that can come out of this type of crisis. And it's just something that's why this collaboration with NCAL and Lifting Up Voices has been so very, very important to all of us. I know Bonnie's been involved with a listening session that I think was more, that again also went into these areas of the Lifting Up Voices campaign. And I know that you're also providing a blog to us that we will be posting on the National Center on Elder Abuse's website. So we're very excited to be getting those materials in. Is there anything else, Bonnie, that we want to make sure that we highlight today?
Julie, I think I would just echo exactly what you just said. It's been a wonderful partnership with the National Center on the World Elder Abuse Awareness materials and a fabulous partnership with Terra Nova Films creating these videos and having these opportunities to continue to advertise that these materials are available. And then at NCAL, we are connected to a number of other national resource centers across the country. And you mentioned the listening session and some other materials that are available from the National Resource Center on Reaching Victims. In the domestic violence and sexual assault space, they've been putting together a lot of materials on how to respond to COVID-19. So if you are working with a domestic violence or a sexual assault program and trying to figure out the specific challenges that you might have with providing virtual services and support groups and how you might want to be doing hotlines or emergency housing differently in this time, they are a great resource to go to with specific information about victim services as well. And then going back to the National Center on Elder Abuse's website to really think about how to add the layer on where we might want to think about doing things a little bit differently or tailoring things specifically for older adults.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought up the website and NCAA also, because we really want to provide people some tips on staying connected during physical distancing. It's very difficult. We use that term physical distancing rather than social distancing because that's what it is. We're physically asking people to stay apart from each other, but we want to stay socially connected. And I think if we can get even just that little change of verbiage going, I think that will help people to cope a little bit better with this. On the website too, we have all types of fact sheets and communications. We want people to be wary of scams that are of course going to impact them during this time, because during any crisis, people take advantage of the anxiety that surrounds them. So, get your information from credible resources. Go directly to the CDC. They're probably not calling you or contacting you. And there is no cure at this time of taping, or there is no vaccine at this particular moment either. So, we have to make a couple phone calls, check into resources a little bit, make sure that we're credible and know what we're dealing with as we move forward and figure this out. And even on our website, one thing that makes me just, kind of lifts my spirits during this time is we have a little video on staying connected during physical distancing. And it has one of our staff members, our team members, Kimmy video conferencing with her grandparents in Korea, and they're making a meal together, you know, over the video. And it's just one of those things that, you know, the lifting up voices and the stories are so compelling, as Jim said. And so when we share them, which, you know, whichever voice they take, we can all be learning and benefiting from them. Jim and Bonnie, do you have any final comments before we kind of wrap up this very, very compelling segment?
I don't have additional comments, Julie, I think, except again, just to thank you and all of the staff at the National Center for the opportunity to do the webinar last year, for continuing to use the theme Lifting Up Voices, and the opportunity to do this podcast with you.
And from me, just to reiterate, what a pleasure it was to work with NCAL on all the projects that we've worked on together. And I'm just really grateful that we have that opportunity to make some difference around this issue of elder abuse.
Absolutely. And as we wrap up here, I just again want to put in a little commercial for World Elder Abuse Awareness Day, which is on June 15th. And that's a time when the world really does come together to promote a better understanding of abuse and neglect of older persons, and by raising awareness. And we do this across cultures and social, economic, and demographic processes so that people can understand the depth and breadth of this issue. And I think they are so well illustrated in the Lifting Up Voices campaign. So to our listeners, I want to again acknowledge and thank so much Bonnie and Jim for their great insights and all their hard work on this passion project. And I encourage everyone to visit our respective websites, watch the videos, and then join us in lifting up the voices of older survivors. Thank you all so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll tune into future podcasts. Thank you so much.